of Jerry Sanderson's boat, the one that Gordon is not allowed to take out. Apparently, Gordon and Tim usually go out in the smaller sailing yacht, but this is the larger motor yacht. He assures me that the boys are quite capable of taking her into the open channel, but she's 45 feet and worth a fortune. He seemed more worried about the yacht, though B is beside herself, like me. Priscilla, I think you and Douglas should go to Ramsgate. He shouldn't be left here to feel he's not playing a part while his son has put himself in the path of danger. You must be together. But Douglas doesn't drive, and if I get behind the wheel, I know I will kill us. Maisie shook her head and took a moment, stopping Priscilla from speaking by holding up a hand. I have another idea. Though Billy doesn't have a motor car, I know he can drive now because he's had a friend teach him. I'll see if he'll take you. In fact, I think he'll jump at the chance because his son is with the expeditionary force and he will want to keep himself occupied doing something useful. I'll telephone him now. Priscilla nodded. Right. And if he agrees, I can at least get us to his home in Eltham to pick him up without causing too much damage. She turned to walk away, but stopped and looked back at Maisie. And at least we'll be doing something, not just sitting around waiting. Chapter 10. Of course I can drive them to Ramsgate. I've been thinking of going down there anyway to keep an eye out for old Billy. Fool's errand, really. I don't stand a chance of seeing him. It'll be like a three-ring circus, and they say not many are getting away, not set against the number over there. But at least I'd feel I was a bit closer. Mind you, I've got to tell you, miss, I've only been behind the wheel of my mate's little Austin, and Mrs. Partridge drives one of them really big old continental motors, doesn't she? Got the steering wheel on the wrong side, hasn't it? Isn't it a Bugatti or a Lagonda, something like that? You could probably get our entire front room in the back seat of her motor. She has a new Bentley, and the steering wheel is on the right side, but don't worry, she collides with something every day, so I am sure there are dents all over the coachwork. This is very good of you, Billy.
Nah, all part of the job, and a Bentley. Well, I'll never get that chance again, will I? Truth is, they must be worried sick. Young Tim should have a hiding for his trouble, no two ways about it. These boys are all losing their minds.
Maisie delivered the news to Priscilla that they should depart now to meet Billy at his home, then placed another call to Billy.
"Right you are, miss," said Billy. "I'll be waiting for them, a bag packed just in case."
"Before you go, Billy, tell me about Archie Coombs."
"Blimey, nearly forgot, what with all the worry going on, and I've been dying to tell you about him."
"Go on," said Maisie, picking up a notebook and pencil.
"He's a fitter at an engineering works in Sydenham, and has lodgings over a shop in Camberwell. One bus ride and he's at his job, though I think he's got a bike. I had a talk with him while he was on a morning break, standing outside having a smoke. It's been a while since I saw him, but he's the dead spitting image of his father, so it's not as if I had to look hard. He seemed a bit shaky, but that's to be expected, and I saw a couple of blokes walk past, stop and talk, put a hand on his shoulder, then move along to light up. Having worked with you for a few year now, I reckon it was the way he was standing. It told people he didn't want company."
"Yes, I can imagine that," said Maisie.
"Anyway, I went over, introduced myself. He throws down the ciggy, holds out his hand, and thanks me for looking after his mum and dad. Then he took out a packet of ciggies again and lit up. That was my first little niggle about him."
"Go on," said Maisie.
"He threw down a half-smoked cigarette end that still had a lot of tobacco in it, and he was not smoking cheap woodbine sold by the ones and twos either. He had a packet of 20.
Billy cleared his throat. Maisie heard a page being turned and knew Billy was referring to his notes.
"I asked him about Joe, about his work down there in Hampshire, and if he'd been down to see him. He said no, he didn't know much about the work. He hadn't actually seen Joe for a while, and he didn't know the area. I asked him about Teddy Wickham, and he said he didn't know where he was stationed exactly, but he knew he'd looked in on Joe, and he'd said his brother seemed on top form.
And how did he know all this? Did Teddy come back on leave?
Yes, that's it, exactly. He had a 48-hour pass a few weeks ago, and he gets on the blower, apparently.
To whom? At the pub? How does Archie take the telephone call?
I'm almost there.
The rustle of another page turning and then flipping back echoed as if there were interference on the line.
He didn't have much to tell me, and he was getting choked up. He said he has a telephone at his digs because he's a supervisor and can be on call at any time. I tell you, miss, I don't believe that for a start. I know men who are supervisors in factories, and they don't all get a free dog and bone. Anyway, the horn went for the men to go back inside the works, and he had to go. Pinched out another hardly smoked ciggy, threw it down, and went back inside.
But you saw him again, didn't you? Said Maisie.
Followed him back to his lodgings, nice and easy, so he couldn't see me. Saw him go in, then come out half an hour later, dressed like 2 pennyworth of ham bone done up for the butcher's window. Good suit, well, a 50-bob Burton special. He looked a bit flash, if you ask me. Reckon he's seen too many of those American pictures. Had shoes on you could see your face in. He waited on the street, and then along comes a motor car. Black, with green down the sides, you know, the doors. Newish, I would say. With a driver in the front, and someone else in the back. I could see him moving forward to open the door. Then Archie got in, and off they went.
Do you know the make of motor?
It looked like a Rover 10. A coupe, I reckon. Because the fellow in the back had to push the front passenger seat for Archie to get in with him. I reckon it was the same one that was parked across the street from the office. The driver must have gone straight over there to Archie's job.
So Archie Coombs has a bit more money than we thought he might, said Maisie. Or at least he has friends who have money. Did you manage to look at the lodgings by any chance?
I went across and knocked on the door. Nicely turned out woman comes to answer and says I'd just missed him. I did my best forlorn look, you know, the one I put on to get round someone, and I said I wanted to leave a message for him. I pulled out my notebook and began scribbling, you know, blah, 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 and I asked if I could put it in his room. She looked suspicious, but I said it was private, and she said she would take me up there so I could just slip it on the table. The table. Lodgings only usually come with a rotten old cast-iron bed with a horsehair mattress and a couple of blankets, perhaps a washstand if you're lucky. So she took me up there, opened the door, and there before me is a very nice garth indeed. 2 rooms, 1 a sitting room, and 1 a bedroom as far as I could see. He had his own furniture put in here, said the landlady, all proud of the room. He says that when he gets his house, he'll leave it here for me.
When he gets his house, said Maisie.
That's what I thought. Doing very well for a lad of, what, 20, is he?
Let's not jump to conclusions. He could just be very careful with his money.
Not buying new suits, he isn't.
The motor car outside. What was the driver like? Did you get a look at him?
Older than Archie. I'd say he was in his 30s or even 40s. But you can never be sure. Not from a distance. And I didn't want to stare and draw attention. I was taking enough of a risk as it was.
Yes, you were, replied Maisie, remembering a time when Billy was beaten up by a suspect in a case and left for dead. She had told him then that under no circumstances must he ever put his life in danger ever again. No job was worth his life. It's unusual, and added to your observations about the Coombs family, it seems there are some significant contradictions.
I'll say there are,
interjected Billy. On the one hand, they are very tight, continued Maisie. They appear a very loving family, very honourable, in fact. But these little things come to the surface, flashes of expenditure on items that would otherwise seem to be out of the budget of a family in their position. And then some discord in the home.
So where's the money coming from?
I think we have to be very careful about following that particular stream, at least until we have more of an idea as to where it might lead. I'll pop in to talk to Phil and Sally again, and I'll see what I can do about finding Teddy Wickham. And I think I want to see Archie myself.
Are you going down to Hampshire?
Yes, but I might wait until I hear back from you or Priscilla.
A silence descended on the conversation. It was broken by Billy.
"You think going down to Ramsgate is a fool's errand, don't you, miss?"
"I confess it was my suggestion, and I certainly think you're right about it being chaotic there, but I know Priscilla, and I know she has to feel as if she has some control over the matter, so going to Ramsgate and being there when boats come in will keep her from losing her mind completely."
"There's talk that this evacuation could go on for days. She won't see him until the end, will she? Because what a lot of these little boats are doing is going in there, picking up men who are waiting, then taking them to bigger ships, the ones that can't get in because of what they draw. It's too shallow."
"You're sounding like a sailor, Billy," said Maisie.
"My boy's over there, so I've been reading up on it, this business of ships and where they can dock, and I've been listening to the wireless. They don't say everything, sort of let out the news bit by bit."
"That's what Douglas said. Apparently it's being orchestrated by a man named Duff Cooper, so people are informed, but not enough to cause panic. He told Douglas that it's no good trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the British people, because they know very well when the language used in newsreels is designed to manipulate them."
"That didn't work, did it? Your friend is panicking for all of us."
"I know, but most people are calm, getting on with their lives."
"Miss, you think the world of Tim. You must be worried sick."
"I am, Billy, really worried, and I'm not sure Ramsgate is the place to wait. When they come back toward the coast, I have a feeling they might make their way to Rye. They'll take their usual route because they will want to get home. And they'll want to get home because they will have seen things they might never have imagined, even in their worst nightmares." Maisie considered her plans for the following day. Phil and Sally Coombs, Mike Yates, and Archie Coombs were all on the list, and Vivian. Vivian Coombs was an interesting study, thought Maisie. Not least because it was fair to assume she wanted to do what both her brothers had done quite successfully, get out from under their parents' roof. When a telephone call came later, it was Priscilla reporting to say they had reached Ramsgate and could find out nothing.
"Maisie, I never thought I would see this sort of thing again, really. Oh, hell, the pips are going. Douglas? Douglas, give me some more change. Right."
There was a brief pause as Priscilla put more coins in the slot.
It's taken me back, Maisie. I feel as if I've been swept into France in 1916. I remember driving back toward a casualty clearing station in my ambulance. I was so new. It was only my second or third run. And I passed a line of men walking the other way, young men who'd been in the trenches, filthy and sodden with mud. A good number wounded. It's like looking at that all over again.
The line crackled and Priscilla's voice was clear again. Anyway,
we've spoken to some officials. Well, they looked official. And no one has a record of this boat that they've gone out on. Cassandra is her name. Well, they wouldn't, would they? The boys joined unofficially and no one was going to turn them back because everyone was so determined to get on themselves.
There was a gasp on the line, followed by a crackling silence.
"Priscilla? Pris? What's wrong?"
"There's a long line of men disembarking one of the boats, and they're walking toward the station for trains to take them back into London. It's a never-ending snake of soldiers. Billy and Douglas were waiting outside for me, and I can't quite see what's happened, but Billy just ran off. I've never seen him move so fast. I can't quite see. Oh, dear, he's almost fallen. It's his weak leg. He shouldn't try to run like that."
Another break in the telephone line, which Maisie recognized as the pips sounding for more money. "I think I've almost run out of coins here, Maisie," continued Priscilla. "I can't say, but I think Billy has seen his son. Gosh, I hope he's not mistaken. It would be so easy. Douglas is walking down there now. Hang on. Let me open the door to get a better look."
There was a pause. Maisie heard voices in the background, the muffled sounds of people moving along outside the kiosk. Priscilla came back on the line.
"Oh, my goodness! Oh, my goodness!"
She wept into the telephone.
It is. It's his son. He's found his son.
And as the line disconnected, Maisie replaced the receiver, brought her hands to her face, and wept as well. For Billy, for Priscilla, and Douglas, and what they already knew of war. She wept, too, for Phil and Sally Coombs. For whatever had come to pass in the family, they had still lost a beloved son. Mike Yates was in his office on the first floor of the old warehouse building, overlooking the brickyard, where two vans were parked and men were loading tools and materials. One of the decorators loading a van directed Maisie up to the office, which was reached via a wooden exterior staircase and through a partially ajar door. A young woman was seated at a desk piled with papers and a ledger, and was typing a letter. Maisie saw the man she assumed was Mike Yates, standing at another desk in a small office that lay beyond a wood partition with pebbled glass windows. The typist did not look up until Maisie cleared her throat.
"He's through there, if you want him," said the woman.
"Oh, all right. Then I can just go in?"
"Door's open. Anyone can go in. Never disturb him if that door's closed, though. Not if you don't want your head blown off."
"Really?" said Maisie.
"Yes, really. He's a nasty man. I'm off to join the ATS next week, and I would rather put up with that than him. Monster. Beaming monster. If he has a go at me this week, I'll just down tools and leave him to it. Him and his bleeming accounts."
"Right, then. I'd better brace myself and go in." Maisie stepped toward the open door, but turned to the young woman. "What's your name, if I may ask?"
"Charlotte Bright."
"Does he let you out for 5 minutes in the morning?"
"He does this week. Can't stop me."
"If he doesn't tell me to leave straight away, could you meet me, perhaps downstairs or along the street, a few minutes after I leave?" Bright looked up from her typewriter.
"Go on. Tell me what he's done. Miserable sod. I bet he's done something. Did you just find out he's married? Told you lies, did he?"
"No, no, not quite. I'm a friend of Joe Coombs' family, and..." The girl's eyes filled with tears.
"Oh, poor Joe. We all thought a lot of Joe. He was lovely. Not like some of them, when they come up to get their wages. Anyone would think I was only here for them to make fun of, and they all think they're so comical with their jokes everyone's heard before."
"I'd better go in," said Maisie. She approached the door to Mike Yates' office and knocked on the glass. "Good morning. Mr. Yates."
"And who's wanting him?"
said Yates, looking up from a stack of papers on his desk. "My name is Maisie Dobbs," said Maisie, deciding to give him her full affiliation. "I am a psychologist and investigator, and I am also a friend of Mr. and Mrs. Philip Coombs, the parents of Joseph Coombs, now deceased, but latterly in your employ." Yates's nut-brown eyes met Maisie's. He took a pencil from behind his ear as if he were about to make a note on the top sheet of paper in front of him, but thought better of it and instead tapped the pencil against the fingers of the opposite hand.
"Yeah, I'd heard someone had been round to talk about Joe. Bloke with a limp. Know him?"
"Yes, that's Mr. Beale. He works for me."
"Works for you? Well, 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 man working for a woman. New one on me. Take a seat, Miss Dobbs. You can ask me all the questions you want to ask about Joe. Silly boy, skylarking around near a railway line. Not able to hold his drink and standing on top of a wall like that."
He shook his head.
"If he'd just had a bit of brain in his noddle, he would have seen that coming."
"How did you find out how Joe died?"
"Freddie Mays telephoned in. He'd found out from the police. Then they came here."
"I see," Maisie sighed. "I wonder, Mr. Yates, what evidence do you have that Joe had been drinking?"
"Freddie told me. I had to ask him in Len on account of the accident. And of course the police have been around. Said it was open and shut. Death by misadventure and all that. But still, I'll be going to see the family, probably tomorrow. Wanted to give them a bit more chance to get over the shock before I turned up. I've got Joe's last pay packet, and a bit extra as a consideration for the family to see them all right. Mind you, that's if Dopey out there can pull herself together to get it all ready for me.
He looked past Maisie to Charlotte Bride and then back again.
Auxiliary Territorial Service, that one. They'll chuck her out after a week of her painting her nails in the dark when she's supposed to be operating a searchlight, you mark my words.
Maisie thought it best to ignore the comment. It's very good of you to visit Joe's people to help them out. They'll need it for the funeral.
Not many firms would do it, but we like to take care of our own here at Yates. Now then, what can I do for you?
Mr. Yates, I am curious to know if Joe was the only one of your men to experience headaches and other symptoms likely associated with the emulsion they've been using the fire retardant and...
How do you know about all that?
Asked Yates. Maisie gave a half smile. I think it's fairly common knowledge that your crews who are currently in Hampshire were working with a type of paint that prevents fire when Air Force buildings are under attack from the enemy. Yates shook his head.
Not one of them can keep a thing to themselves, that lot.
Were they supposed to?
Were they, heck? I told every one of them, if anyone asks, you're just giving the buildings a lick of paint, making everything nice for when old Adolf waltzes right in.
Maisie sighed, wondering how she might continue the conversation and perhaps tease more information out of Yates.
You can't stop lads talking about their work or anything else when they're away from home.
She held Yates's gaze.
Do you know what's in that emulsion, Mr. Yates? Do you know if it's been tested properly?
Mike Yates walked away from his desk toward a window. He stared down at the yard below, and after a minute had passed, an uncomfortable interlude, during which Maisie thought she should have perhaps not pressed her point, Yates turned back to answer the question.
I don't know if it's been tested at all. I was asked about the job, and I got it. You don't turn down a government contract like that, and I know my blokes would agree. They've all got to put roofs over their heads and food on the table. If they get a headache, they can take an aspirin powder for their trouble.
So the contract just came to you. You didn't have to bid for it.
Sometimes it works like that. Sometimes you bid against other firms, and sometimes you're just asked to give an estimate. And you're in. That was how this one was done. I was in.
You must know some important people, Mr. Yates. Yates's eyes appeared to narrow as if the aperture through which he viewed her had been altered.
What's it to you, Miss Dobbs?
Maisie leaned forward, not allowing herself to be intimidated by Yates, and this time casting several more cards on the table. Here's what it is to me, Mr. Yates. Joe Coombs was a happy-go-lucky lad. I've seen him grow from a young boy into a thoughtful young man. Still green, admittedly, but a diamond all the same. And doing this job changed him. And not simply because he'd had a taste of being one of the older lads. I know this work had a profound physical impact on him, but I know something else, too. Joe was worried sick. He was fed up with doing what he was doing, and I don't think the painting was the doing that he hated. There was something else, and I am bound and determined to find out what it was, if nothing else, so his parents can be at peace, if that's possible. Yates stared at Maisie, then looked out of the window again. Seconds later, he turned back, taking his seat once more. He leaned forward, hands clasped on top of the sheaf of papers.
There's nothing more to tell you, Miss Dobbs. What you're saying doesn't make sense to me. You might as well be talking Greek. I sent Joe Coombs off to work with a crew on a job a lot of lads his age would jump at the chance of doing, and he goes soft on me, talking his head off about what he's doing when he was supposed to keep his trap shut, and then getting himself drunk enough to kill himself. Where's your truth, Miss Dobbs? And I'm sorry, I can't make it easier for you to swallow.
Maisie came to her feet and held out her hand. Thank you for your time, Mr. Yates. I am much obliged to you for your candor. I am sure Joe's parents would love to hear from you, and for you to tell them what a wonderful young apprentice he was.
Mike Yates ignored the outstretched hand and instead yelled past her. Oi, Miss Not-So-Bright, if you could drag yourself away from your penny dreadful for a minute, would you see Miss Dobbs down to the yard?
Maisie turned and left the small office and was joined by Bright, who put down a sheaf of papers and rose from her desk to escort her to the yard below. She did not speak until they were on the stairs.
Don't take any notice of him, crabby human being that he is. Cheek of it, I only pick up a book when he hasn't anything for me to do, and I don't read stupid stuff either. I'd argue back, but it's not worth my breath, him and his flash friends.
What flash friends? Asked Maisie. He doesn't look the type.
They never look the type, according to my mum, these crooks. I reckon it was one of his dodgy friends who got him that contract.
Does he mix with people like that? Bright shook her head.
He seems the type to me. If you come from where I come from, you know about that sort of thing.
She sighed.
Well, I don't really know about that sort of thing personally, but my dad does.
What does your dad do that he knows this sort of thing? Asked Maisie.
He's a copper, sergeant at Carter Street Police Station.
That's interesting, said Maisie.
It probably is, as long as you're not related to him. Treats me like I'm a criminal half the time. What time are you going out? What time are you coming back? Which bus are you catching? Who are you going with?
I like to go out to the dance halls with my friends. We don't get up to anything wrong.
Just dancing to the swing bands, playing the latest numbers, having a bit of fun. The way my dad talks, the musical world begins and ends with Gracie Fields singing about Walter taking her to the altar. She sighed. I know I've already told you this, but I can't wait to get into the ATS, away from all of them.
Maisie laughed. Your dad's like that because he loves you, Charlotte. In his job, he's seen too much, so he's just worried about you. Give him a chance, won't you?
I suppose you're right. But it don't half get on my nerves sometimes, all the questions. Anyway, nice to meet you, Miss Dobbs, and tell Joe's people I was sorry to hear the news about him. I liked Joe. He was a good sort. Not like that brother of his.
Maisie touched Charlotte Bright on the arm as she was about to turn away. How do you know his brother?
Came round here once or twice looking for Joe. Just before this job started, the big contract. I didn't like the look of him. I mean, he was nice enough, but not like Joe. Seemed a bit harder around the edges. Joe was sort of innocent, as if he would still be a bit of a boy when he was 80. Anyway, I've got to rush. The governor will be docking my pay if I'm out here any longer.
Maisie glanced up at the office window. Mike Yates was looking down at them. She turned away and left the yard, just as a black and green Rover 10 swung through the gates. "Where's Martin today?" asked Maisie, a little disappointed to see Sandra at the office without her son.
"Lawrence's aunt is staying with us and said she would look after him today, so I've had some time to myself. I hate to say it, but it's quite lovely. But just for a little while."
She laid a hand upon a pile of papers.
"I've caught up with the letters, and there are 3 invoices for you to sign before I send them out. And the filing is done too. What does Billy do when I'm not here? There were pages everywhere."
She held up her finger as if it were a reminder.
"Oh, Mrs. Partridge telephoned. No news of Tim was her first comment. I wasn't going to ask her what she was talking about, but she told me anyway. What does he think he's doing at his age? Going off in a boat over there to where it's terrible. We've been listening to the wireless and..."
"What did she say?" asked Mary.
Just that a coast guard had told her the best thing she could do would be to go home and wait and not get in the way. She sounded very angry and very distraught, and who could blame her? So she said she's coming back and Billy's driving them.
Sandra's voice changed, a smile readily spreading where before there was consternation.
Isn't it a miracle about Billy's son? Who would have imagined that could happen? Anyway, he's with his mates now, on their way to their barracks, according to Mrs. Partridge, though she says he had some sort of shoulder wound. She told me that Billy had wanted his son to come home with them, but young Billy said he couldn't. Well, obviously, he had to go back to barracks. He's a soldier, after all. But at least Billy had good news for Doreen.
Maisie nodded and placed her bag on Billy's desk as she pulled up a chair to sit down opposite Sandra. There was gentle warmth in their exchange, and Maisie felt a need for that cocoon of belonging, of being with someone she had known for a long time. Were there any other telephone calls, Sandra?
Just one. From Mr. Klein? Wants you to telephone him back soonest, he said. There's a slight snag with the Ministry of Health that needs to be addressed. That's all he said. Is it about...
Thank you, Maisie interrupted. I'll telephone him now. Maisie stood up, grabbed her bag, and stepped into her office.
Excuse me, Sandra, just for a minute, she added as she closed the door, separating her room from the outer office.
Maisie was put through to the solicitor with no delay.
Slight problem, Maisie. Not a huge one, but, well, any snag at this point could become more serious if we don't nip it in the bud.
Chapter 11 Maisie was torn. Should she go to Hampshire again, remain in London, or should she follow her heart, which would be to drive down to Rye to see if Tim and his friend would return to the place where the vessel was usually moored. She looked at the clock and turned on the wireless in her office. Stepping toward the sliding doors again, she drew them back. I'm about to listen to the news on the wireless. Come on in if you want to, Sandra.
British and French troops last night held Calais and Dunkirk. The French official communique stated that Boulogne had been taken by the Germans after the fierce street fighting. German shock troops attacking on the outskirts of Boulogne were smashed by shells from British warships firing over the town. The battle for Calais is still south of the town. British soldiers fought magnificently with the French to repulse every enemy attack yesterday. And across the Atlantic, President Roosevelt told the USA to prepare for the approaching storm, stressing the futility, the impossibility of the idea of isolation. He said, obviously, a defense policy based on that is merely to invite future attack.
The two women listened to the news for a few more minutes before Maisie switched off the set.
It never occurred to me that it would be a good idea to have a wireless in the office, said Sandra.
But since the war started and you brought it in, at least we can keep up with what's going on. And it brings us all together, considering everyone across the country's listening.
I sometimes wonder if the news is helpful to us, said Maisie, or if it just makes us more anxious. If Tim and his friend are in the midst of this, it could be days before they come home. Gordon's parents have asked the Coast Guard to look out for the boat, but according to Priscilla, Gordon's father has joined the flotilla, and he hopes to find them along the way. They were jolted from speculation by the telephone. Sandra answered the call.
Billy! Billy!
She looked at Maisie, who held out her hand.
You're just leaving Mrs. Partridge's house? All right, Billy. I'm passing you over to her now.
Billy, said Maisie, grasping the receiver. I've heard your good news. You must be beyond relieved, and what a miracle.
Miracle? I never believed in them, but now I do, miss. I thought I would go on my knees right there and then. Talk about a weight off my mind. It's been like carrying around 100 weight of coal. But let me tell you, I reckon they need all the miracles they can get, our army over there.
You should see the state of them. My boy isn't my boy any more, miss. He looked like his granddad, and he looks like the lads I was with in the war. That long stare, as if they've seen into the devil's eyes. Put years on him, this has, but at least he's on his feet, though he's got a nasty shoulder wound. The important thing is that he's back now, he's over here, and he's not over there. Miss, they say there's thousands of our boys waiting to be rescued. Thousands of them. And according to Billy, Hitler's blaming Luftwaffe are strafing men while they wait, and they're bombing the ships what are coming in to save them. And down in Ramsgate, I've never seen anything like it. There's more soldiers than I imagined disembarking. Then there's the people coming in to help. You know, when we heard about the evacuation of Dunkirk, I don't think I had it in my head what it looked like and what the soldier and the navy are going through. Tell you the truth, I still don't, not really. I can only get a picture of it from what I've been told. Old Billy said to me, "Dad, at least I'm home. I'm home." And now I keep thinking about the ones waiting to get away. All that waiting. And the hoping. All right, Billy, you must go straight home to see Doreen. At least Mr. and Mrs. Partridge are safely back in Holland Park. I do all but drag Mrs. P, but the authorities don't want civilians getting in the way down there unless they've got a job to do. And even she realised that she was doing more harm than good, but who can blame her? I'm glad Mr. P was there. He's like a solid rock, isn't he? Stalwart, that's what he is. And he takes care of her and keeps her from doing a mischief to herself. And they reckon this evacuation is going to take days and days. Douglas knows what she's been through. This is her most dreadful nightmare coming true. She knows the whereabouts of only one of her three sons, and it's a wonder she hasn't handcuffed him to his bed so he doesn't move while she's away. Well, she's home now, and that's where I'm going. Off to see Doreen and Margaret Rose, if that's all right, then I'll be in the office later. Don't worry, Billy, come in tomorrow. What about Hampshire? I'm not sure, but I think I'll leave soon. You don't sound very sure, miss. It's Tim and... There's nothing you can do, miss. That's what Mr. and Mrs. P realised. Nothing you can do until he comes back in. And if his pal is anything like him, they won't come home until it's over. Until they've done everything they can for our boys. That's what worries me, said Maisie. There was something about driving that made Maisie feel cocooned from the world around her. Looking out onto streets where people were going about their daily round until the town gave way to countryside again. Catching glimpses of farmers at work, a horse-drawn plough turning the soil, or workers marching from one field to another. It was easy to believe the war was nothing more than a nightmare that would come to an end soon, that the country would wake up and any threat of an invasion by a ruthless enemy would have evaporated. Time would march on, the seasons would pass, and death would come after 80 years and 10, and with good fortune, perhaps a few more years added on to enjoy a life well lived. Mrs. Keep welcomed Maisie with a cup of tea, home-baked scones, and the promise of a room always ready for her whenever she came to the farm. Once refreshed, Maisie set her bag in the room, dropped in to say hello to Doreen's aunt, and went on her way, this time in the direction of the airfield where she believed Teddy Wickham was stationed. Would she be able to see him? Would her name still be on a list that gave her preferential access? She had not wanted to trouble Lord Julian again, but was now having second thoughts and wished she had. As before, there were two guards stationed at the gatehouse when she drove up. She pulled into a lay-by opposite their station, reached into her handbag and took out her identity card. She wound down the window and held out the card. "Good afternoon, Sergeant. I wonder if I could speak to the officer in charge, if I may. My name is Maisie Dobbs. Here is my calling card." She took one of the cards from her pocket. She did not wish to appear too confident of her position, but at the same time wanted to get answers to questions as soon as she could. "I believe my name should be on a list here. Perhaps it's with the officer in charge."
"Right you are, miss. Remain in your motor car, if you don't mind."
The sergeant returned to the gatehouse and stepped inside. Through the open door, Maisie could see him winding up the telephone and placing a call.
The conversation seemed to take longer than she had expected, but at last he replaced the receiver and walked back toward the Alvis.
"Sergeant Packham had to go through some papers, Miss Dobbs. He'd remembered seeing your name, but the permission to enter had been filed away. Now then, when I lift the gate, you may proceed to the building situated to your right as you drive up there. Do not exceed 5 miles per hour and do not stop. You will see where to park your vehicle, and a guard will be waiting to escort you to an office where Sergeant Packham will see you."
Maisie nodded and thanked the guard, who proceeded to lift a barrier, waving her through as she drove on, taking care to keep the Alvis at the specified speed, tantamount to hardly moving. She followed instructions for parking. An armed guard approached the motor car, opened the door, and instructed her to
"Follow me, madam."
Upon entering the long, one-story building, she smelled fresh paint and could see the job had been finished recently, perhaps in the last fortnight. The guard stopped outside a door, knocked, and was given leave to enter. An officer and a sergeant were waiting in the room and returned the guard's salute. The room was cool and felt damp and seemed infused with the vapor of fresh emulsion. It was oppressive, reminding her of an interrogation room at Scotland Yard.
"Miss Dobbs," said the officer. "Right, Lieutenant Cobb, and this is Sergeant Packham. Please take a seat."
He extended a hand toward a chair opposite a single desk in the room. Cobb took a seat on the other side of the desk while Packham remained standing.
"Now, how might we help you, Miss Dobbs? Is this to do with the painters?"
Maisie looked from Cobb to Packham. "Yes, I'm afraid it is in connection with the death of one of the young apprentices, Joseph Coombs. I'm given to understand that a friend of his brother named Edward, Teddy Wickham, is stationed here. He visited Mr. Coombs a few weeks before his death and subsequently told the deceased's parents that their son had been in top form. I would like to see Wickham, if I may. I would like to ask him a few questions about his meeting with Joseph Coombs."
"Is there a suspicion of foul play in the death of the young apprentice?"
asked Cobb. "The inquest has yet to take place, but in all likelihood the coroner will conclude death by misadventure."
"Young lad playing fast and loose with fate, eh?"
said Cobb. "Perhaps not," said Maisie. "Might I see Wickham?" Cobb turned to Sergeant Packham.
"Where is Corporal Wickham at the moment?"
Packham lifted an open ledger from the desk and began to run his finger down the page.
"In the hangar, sir,"
he replied.
"Ask the guard to fetch him and bring him to this office."
He turned to Maisie.
"I should like to be present during your inquisition, if that's all right," said Cobb.
Maisie took account of Cobb's stance. He had now come to his feet. It occurred to her that perhaps in civilian life he had not known much respect from his peers, that he had yearned for a measure of power, some sense of having an edge over others. He had possibly been all but invisible in school days, hence his need to sit while the sergeant stood, affirming his position, and then to stand as soon as the sergeant had left the room. Maisie leaned back in the chair, placing her elbows on the arms and stretching into the space allowed her. "I'd like to talk to him in private, if that's all right," said Maisie. "It might be easier if Corporal Wickham had no cause to feel intimidated by the presence of an officer in the room. You are, after all, his superior." She left the word superior hanging, suspended in the air between them, a word chosen to stroke an ego as if it were a dog to be calmed.
"Yes, quite," said Cobb.
A single knock at the door signalled Packham's entrance, with Teddy Wickham close behind. The young man was of average height, about 5 feet 10 inches, and with reddish-blonde hair. His grey eyes held no sparkle, though as soon as he saw Cobb, he snapped to attention, his chest pushed out and his back ramrod straight when he saluted the officer.
"At ease, Wickham," said Cobb. "This is Miss Dobbs,
She has something to discuss with you in private, which I am allowing on this occasion.
He looked at Maisie, again as if to underline his position.
A guard will be waiting outside and will escort you to your motor car directly you've finished in here, Miss Dobbs.
He turned back to Wickham.
And, Corporal, you will immediately return to your duties.
He pronounced the word immediately.
Yes, sir.
Wickham saluted again, his heels snapping together.
And please don't do that. You look like a bloody Nazi,
added Cobb as he and Packham left the room. You can breathe again and sit down now, Teddy. Pull up that chair so you're on this side of the desk.
Are you sure, miss? I mean...
Of course. Come on.
Sit down. Wickham picked up his chair and set it down so that it was diagonally situated to Maisie, not opposite and not alongside. She smiled. Whether deliberate or instinctive, he had seated himself in a neutral place.
"What do you want to talk to me about?"
asked Wickham. "Joe Coombs," said Maisie. Teddy Wickham nodded and looked down at his hands.
"I heard he was dead. Probably the job. What did it?"
"Tell me what you mean, Teddy."
"Being away from home. Joe was a soft one. And all this business going around painting these buildings, it wasn't doing him any good at all."
He had leaned forward, his shoulders rounded, his arms now folded. "But you said he was on top form. Those were your exact words, according to Phil Coombs."
"Well, he was, in a way. But it was as if he couldn't get comfortable. On one hand, he was having a bit too much fun with the lads, if you ask me. I mean, he wasn't used to the late nights, that sort of thing. And on the other, he was on his own, the apprentice, not one of the boys."
"Late nights? That doesn't sound like the Joe I knew," said Maisie. Wickham looked up.
"Didn't know you knew him."
"Yes, I know Phil and Sally, and I knew Joe. Not Archie, though," she sighed. "What makes you think Joe was having that many late nights? Was he drinking?" Wickham shrugged.
"Might have been. He was away from home, away from having the collar round his neck, so he was enjoying himself."
Maisie folded her arms and leaned forward, mirroring Wickham.
"What do you do here, Teddy?"
"All sorts, but mainly stores, supplies, and ordering. Boring, really. But it's steady, and I won't be out there fighting, or up there in the air fighting, or on a ship fighting."
"Not a bad move," said Maisie.
"Wasn't deliberate. Luck of the draw. It's where I ended up."
"Do you get much leave?"
"More than some, I suppose. More than them going up and over there to fight the Germans."
"So that's how you were able to see Joe, make sure he was all right?"
"Saw him a couple of times."
"How did you manage to get into the stores job? Sounds like a cushy number to me. What did you do before you joined up?" asked Maisie.
"I worked in a warehouse. Same sort of thing. They like to use what you've already got, I suppose. And like I said, it's the luck of the draw, always is."
Maisie nodded. "Where was the warehouse where you worked before the war?"
"Sydenham."
"Oh, then you weren't far from Archie, then?" Wickham shrugged.
"No, not far. Just up the road. He's got a job that keeps him in Civvy Street, though. Jammy, what's it, that he is."
Maisie nodded, and when she spoke, it was with a softer voice. "You're very upset about Joe, aren't you, Teddy?" Wickham looked away.
"Well, I would be, wouldn't I? My mate's little brother, dead. Because no one was looking after him."
"What do you mean, Teddy? I thought the men he worked with were keeping an eye on him."
"Well, they weren't sharp enough, were they? Didn't stop him ending up dead, did they?"
"Perhaps they didn't know what he was up to," said Maisie, her tone remaining modulated. Wickham looked up at the clock on the wall.
I've got to get back. Miss Dobbs. Got a shipment coming in, big one. Everything from parts for vehicles, parts for aeroplanes, medical supplies, all that sort of thing. Right down to T in Bovril, and I've got to check it all through on the ledgers. Maisie said nothing, maintaining her gaze upon him so that when he looked up he found himself staring straight into her eyes.
What?
He said. What are you afraid to tell me, Teddy? The young man shook his head, stood up and moved the chair back to its place behind the desk. He stood as if to attention in front of Maisie and saluted before opening the door. Maisie heard his stride along a corridor, then a door opening, and as she left the room to greet the guard, she glanced out of a window and saw Wickham walking at speed toward an aircraft hangar, his hands curled into fists by his side.
"This way, ma'am,"
said the guard, one hand steadying the rifle slung over his shoulder. When they reached the motor car, the guard opened the door for Maisie to take her seat. He closed the door behind her and stood to watch as she manoeuvred the Alvis around and began to drive at the same low speed toward the exit. Another guard approached the barrier, lifting it for her to pass, then directed her across into a lay-by of sorts and held up his hand for her to remain in place. He looked along the lane, leading to the airfield, and beckoned a lorry forward, which Maisie could see was followed by three similar vehicles. The guard checked the papers, handed to him by each driver, and as the lorries moved off, the engines roared and whined. Having secured the gate, the guard waved her forward and on her way. A mile or so along the road, she passed two more lorries, with boxes being loaded from one to the other. The first lorry was similar to those she had passed at the airfield, and the second bore the Yates Company livery. There were no tins or barrels or anything that might contain paint to be seen. Making her way back along country lanes, Maisie was thinking about Teddy Wickham when she heard the low drone of aircraft approaching. She stopped the motor car next to a five-bar gate overlooking the green fields beyond and stepped out. Leaning on the gate, she looked up at the aeroplanes as they flew overhead, two Hurricanes and three Spitfires, if she were not mistaken, toward the coast and in all likelihood bound for France. And she remembered another time, at an airfield outside Munich just 2 years earlier, when she watched a young aviatrix, Elaine Otterburn, take off on a mission to save the life of a man valuable to Britain's preparations for war, and her words, as she had watched the aircraft disappear into the clouds. "Godspeed," Maisie whispered those same words again as the aircraft became specks in the distance. The interview with Teddy Wickham troubled Maisie, not simply because she believed, indeed she knew, that he had lied to her, but also for one other reason. As Teddy Wickham had left her, he was fighting back tears. But were they tears of the bereaved, tears of guilt, or perhaps an expression of fear? She stopped at a bakery to buy a cheese roll and then at a grocer's, where she bought a bottle of ginger beer and considered her next move. She wanted to see Freddie and Len again, the two painters who were working with Joe and who, as the senior men, were supposed to be training him in his job, in particular Freddie Mays. Driving back into Whitchurch, she stopped at the telephone kiosk and placed a call to Yates's yard. As soon as the sing-song voice answered, she knew she was in luck.
"Yates is painting and decorating. How may I help you?"
The speaker's tone seemed to begin on a low note and end on a high one. "Hello, is this Miss Bright? Charlotte?" There was a pause before the woman replied with a lowered voice.
"That's Miss Dobbs. I recognize your voice.
Charlotte, would you be able to give me some information, please?"
"What sort of information?"
Her voice was now little more than a whisper. "Can you tell me where Freddie and Len are today? I'm in Hampshire, and I'd like to see them."
Let me see. Just a minute."
Maisie could hear the turning of pages. Then Bright was back on the line.
"Yes, I thought so. They moved on from that last airfield, and they're now at another place. RAF Templeton? Nearer the coast, it is. Have you got a map?"
Yes, I have, and I've also a list of the RAF stations, so I have everything I need. Is everything all right, Charlotte?
Mark Yates gave me my cards this morning. Said that seeing as I was leaving anyway, I might as well be gone sooner rather than later, especially as he had another girl coming from the Labour Exchange with better qualifications than me. Made a point of telling me she was brighter than me. I hate that man, and I'd like to know what someone with so-called better qualifications is doing coming here.
You'll be in uniform soon anyway, said Maisie.
Counting down the hours, Miss Dobbs. Counting down the hours.
Maisie laughed. Charlotte, I've another question. As I was leaving the other day, a motor car came into the yard. It was a black and green Rover 10. Do you know who it belongs to? There was a brief pause before Bright answered.
I shouldn't say, you know, what with that form I had to sign, the one about keeping quiet about what I do here. But seeing as this is my last day, I don't give tuppence halfpenny for Yates and his secrets. That motor car belongs to a bloke called Jimmy Robertson, but that wasn't him driving it. No, that was one of his T-boys, that's what my dad calls them. The blokes down the ladder from the top. Robertson has a finger in a lot of pies, and he comes here because one of the pies he has a finger in is the painting business. He supplies that special paint and helped get Mike Yates that contract. I'm not supposed to know that, but I do. Oh, hang on.
There was a pause, then Bright came back on the line.
No, madam, I'm afraid it wasn't Yates painting and decorating. I've looked up the records. However, Yates would be more than happy to give you an estimate. Shall I get Mr. Yates to telephone you? No? All right. Thank you, madam.
Charlotte, could you give me your address quickly, just in case I have any more questions for you? The young woman recited her address in a low voice, adding a hurried goodbye. Maisie left the telephone kiosk and sat in her motor car, staring straight ahead, deep in thought, paying no attention to her surroundings. She sighed, shook her head, and spoke aloud as if someone else were in the Alvis, and she had asked for their opinion. Jimmy Robertson. That's all I need, Jimmy Robertson. Maisie had never met Jimmy Robertson, though she had heard of him. Had not everyone in South London heard of the Robertson family? In the office where she kept the card file started by Maurice, a resource used throughout her apprenticeship and which she continued to refer to, there was a clutch of cards, each one bearing a Christian name followed by the surname Robertson. The family's tentacles reached into almost every business south of the river, and, she had heard, possibly even into Westminster. No wonder Sergeant Bright worried about his daughter. It beggared belief that he had ever allowed her to work for Mike Yates if that was the company he kept. Jimmy Robertson was known to be ruthless with those who crossed him. She remembered hearing about one of Robertson's T-boys, a man who had, on the orders of Jimmy Robertson, been dismembered before his body was set in concrete and thrown into the Thames. It was Caldwell who had told her. The word on the street is that Barney Coleman's now holding up Rotherhithe docks, and they say Jimmy Robertson started cutting him before he was dead. Robertson was not someone to be underestimated. Barney Coleman was his cousin. She had intended to place a call to Chelstone to ask after Anna's health, but looked at the single penny left in her purse. She would have to do it later. Instead, she started the engine and slipped the motor car into gear, her thoughts on the conversation with Charlotte Bright. An unexpected thread was now running through the web. It happened, though not often. But this time, perhaps that single thread might be the one to pull. As she made her way to RAF Templeton, checking the map at every junction, she wondered what counsel Maurice might offer. She remembered a story he had told about a sojourn in Morocco as a young man. He explained that in times past, for the early morning and evening Muslim call to prayer, the muezzin had no means of telling the correct time, the exact moments of dawn and dusk. So from their balcony high up on the minaret, they would hold two threads in the palm of one hand, a black thread and a white thread. When they could see no distinction between white and black at night, that was the time to begin their call. And in the morning, as soon as they could distinguish the white thread, so they would summon the faithful to prayer.
Maurice had taken a pencil and paper and drawn a minaret, so that she might know what this tower, part of the mosque, looked like. She knew then, as she turned off onto another lane, that for all her work on a case map and despite the colours used to follow each thread of evidence collected, she was still at the dawn of her investigation, for she could not distinguish